All right. So all right. Having a new kitten is fun.
Yeah, man, I still have not introduced our two cats. You're wild and out there. You're like, here's a new fucking cat.
Well, I just, both Poor and Venkman are, while they're older, like in the grand scheme of things, like they're still not old. And I felt like it would probably be easier to introduce a kitten than it would be to introduce like another adult cat.
Yeah.
If it were another adult cat, we probably would have taken a little bit more time and done a slower introduction. But I mean, we were monitoring them. We didn't let her be out without us until Friday. And that was just when Elise came to get me and like come back home. So it was like 15 minutes that we weren't here. And we haven't had any issues with either of the cats. Just Poor hissing.
I didn't think you were like bad parents. I was just saying it was wild. I was like, I'm like, you can meet the other cats after a full month, maybe longer. You must look at each other first.
We had, we did let them in to the room, like the first day, just to kind of like in the bedroom. So just to kind of get the bearings and smell the kitten and then like ushered them out. So they weren't like completely surprised when there was suddenly a kitten in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the only other situation that we've had is Venkman has a really high prey drive, like hunting instinct, and the kitten thinks that she is Sonic, and she just was running across the floor, and I think he just caught her out of his peripheral and was just like, what is that thing? I'm gonna fucking kill it. And then was like, oh, it's the kitten, never mind. Like, so he just like chased her for like 2 feet and then stopped and was like, oh wait, I don't want to get in trouble.
Are you sleeping?
Hmm?
Are you sleeping? Like, people sleep, have trouble sleeping with a new baby in the house, you know?
The first few nights, we kept her with the door shut in the bedroom with us. Just to make sure that there weren't any issues while we were asleep. And, you know, to kind of still help her have that, like, safe space to go to and reinforce that. And she did not, when she got a taste of the whole house, She was like, wild world. She was like, oh, fuck no. I don't want to be out there, but I don't want this door shut. Like, yep. So she would don't just go and
fence
meow.
Me in.
She would just go and meow at the door, and then we would open the door, and she would just go and hide. Yeah. And I'm like, well, okay. So I'm going to shut the door again. No, don't shut the door. I want out. I don't want out. I changed my mind.
Cats are dumb.
She's enjoying the canned food, though, that's for sure.
Welcome to The Strange and Unusual, where we discuss the strange and unusual. This is episode 122 of our series, seeking out the weird, the unexplained, and the devious from around the world. I'm Casey.
And I'm Roya.
And these next two episodes, we will be discussing crimes that just keep getting weirder. A Pandora's box of murder, if you will. So be sure to check us out on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just check out The Strange and Unusual. We'll have all that information at the end of the episode and in our show notes. Also, we're on patreon.com/strangeunusual as well. And we're out there doing the work, except for when we're not, which has been... You know, it's just been a rough year.
It has been. It's been a very interesting, quote unquote, italicized, interesting year. ..
Really something. So what will you be telling me about today, Roya?
I am going to be talking to everyone. Don't be selfish.
No, it's just me. You're just doing this for me. It's for us.
I am going to be unraveling the very strange... series of events that the kidnapping of Michael Hughes caused in 1994.
Ooh, okay, I'm excited to hear about this because I don't think I'm super familiar with this case.
I wasn't either. I saw this, I will have a couple of recommendations throughout the episode of different things that I watched for it. One of them is a documentary that literally came out like last month or something on Netflix. And so I was just like, perfect timing. Okay. Recommend everyone to go watch this.
Love that.
So we lose murder, child abuse, a child bride, kidnapping, rape, and incest. Kinda. Nope.
I don't like these.
Yeah, it's not a fun one, guys.
What was the guy's name?
The guy who committed the crimes?
Yeah.
He's got like 8 names, but his real name is Franklin Floyd.
Oh, okay.
So on September 12th, 1994, in Oklahoma City, the police department got a very strange call reporting that a man was found handcuffed to a tree by a citizen.
Okay. What a start. Where'd it go?
The man was conscious and had like a piece of like duct tape that had been put around his mouth that had fallen away, which allowed him to call out for help. And just like a dude who was mowing his lawn found him, from what I've been led to believe based on my research.
All right. Well.
When the police arrived on the scene to help, they learned the victim's name was James Davis, the principal of the local elementary school. He had been tied to the tree for 4 hours before he was finally found, and he was very concerned, stating that a gunman had forced him into the woods and handcuffed him and tied him to the tree before leaving with one particular child, Michael Hughes.
Oh no.
Now, the police began to act even more quickly, knowing that a young child was now missing. James Davis relayed the story that he had been at work, and around 9 a.m., a man came to school requesting to check Michael Hughes out of school for the day. This man claimed that Michael was his son. This strange man threatened James Davis with the gun if he didn't get Michael Hughes. Basically, from what James said, he said, I don't have a reason to live without that boy, or something like that. And so, James was taking him very seriously when he saw the gun. And feeling as though he had no other option, since the man was armed, and they were in a fully staffed elementary school full of children, James took the man to Michael's classroom and got him out. Again, keep in mind, this was 1994. So this was before there was, you know, police officers in schools. This is before there was active shooter training. This was before any of that bullshit had to happen.
Not like having police in schools actually does anything.
Yeah, not as much as you'd think. It actually makes things worse by standards that we understand now. Anyway, so despite having Michael, the man took James Davis to his own truck and had him drive them to the nearest wooded area where he tied James and left with Michael in James's truck. That's important later.
Okay.
James stated that the man identified himself as Franklin Floyd, and immediately an APB was put out for his arrest. Also, I don't know if anyone else didn't know this for a long time, but I was an embarrassing age when I learned that APB stood for All Points Bulletin, and BOLO was Be on the Lookout.
All right. What's the embarrassing age?
Like, in my upper 20s.
Oh, I was going to say, like, today years old.
No, not that bad. But, you know, just if anyone else didn't know, I might just be dumb, and that's fine, too. I've accepted that. Unfortunately, this gave... What?
Sorry, I was just... My silence speaks volumes.
Unfortunately, this gave Floyd a 4-hour head start, and due to the likelihood of him leaving the state, combined with kidnapping a small child, the OKCPD reached out to Joseph Fitzpatrick of the local FBI branch. And Joe Fitzpatrick is a badass. I really liked him in all of the documentaries I watched.
I love that. Love that.
They immediately went to Michael's foster family and broke the news of his kidnapping.
Oh, he was a foster kid?
Uh-huh.
Yikes.
Yeah, they found out that his mother died 4 years ago, and her name was Tanya Hughes, and he had entered the care the day after her passing.
Okay.
Michael was not with his father, Franklin Floyd, because Franklin had been arrested for jumping bond on an arrest from over a decade before. So basically, his dad had visitation, and he still had, he had not signed over any custody officially or parental rights or anything. And he was very much adamantly trying to get Michael back into his custody full time. The foster family wanted to adopt Michael after having been his parents for the majority of his life at this point, but Franklin had refused to give up custody to them.
Hmm.
Because keep in mind, they had had Michael for 4 years at this point and been his only foster family.
Right.
So realistically, they were the only family he would remember.
Yeah, that he knew.
Yeah. And so the whole thing with like the foster system and everything is like the father has to go through a mandatory DNA test just to confirm custody and blah 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 for paperwork and everything to make sure everything is good. And when they receive some startling news from the DNA test stating that Franklin was in fact not Michael's biological father, things start getting even stranger.
Okay. Well,
and after finding out that Franklin was not actually Michael's father, the FBI and police got increasingly concerned with every passing hour. His foster mother reported seeing a man who looked like Franklin, who at this time in his life was going by Clarence Hughes, in a car that matched what Clarence Hughes / Franklin Floyd was last seen driving. And I do apologize ahead of time. I really tried to keep names straight by eras that they were using them in, but these people had like fucking 6 different names that they used throughout their lifetimes.
Okay.
So bear with me, it gets a little muddled later on. So the main concern was that if there was no blood connection between the two, and Franklin was aware of this, that there was no real reason for him to keep this kid. There was no real connection to this child, and so there was a growing concern that with every passing hour, they were less likely to find Michael alive, even more so than if Franklin was his biological father.
Right.
The investors began to dig into Franklin's file and found out a lot of troubling information.
Oh, no.
Including him abducting and sexually assaulting a 4-year-old girl.
Ew.
When he was 19, he was sent to jail for that crime for the first time and escaped 8 months after his being put in there. And then he was caught robbing a bank 24 hours later. Like an idiot. He continued committing crimes into his 30s, trying to abduct and attack women. There was a woman in the 70s who actually escaped and filed a report. And then Franklin Floyd disappeared from 1973 until 1990.
That is a big chunk of time.
Yeah. When his wife, Tanya, died, he tried to cash in her life insurance policy under a fake name, Clarence Hughes. He was then caught for the 1973 attempted kidnapping as a result of trying to defraud the life insurance company and was sentenced to 3 years. 6 months after his release, he kidnapped Michael.
I want to know how he knew Michael. What's the whole deal here? I have so many questions.
There's a lot.
I'm already confused.
You're gonna have a lot more questions as okay. This goes on before you get answers.
Okay.
Even though Tanya Hughes had passed away by this point, the investigators wanted to know more about her. They discovered that shortly before her death in 1990, Tanya had been working at a strip club near Tulsa, Oklahoma called Passions. She became close to 2 other dancers there, Karen and Livonia, which is such a good name.
Livonia.
They described her as being friendly, energetic, and very, very intelligent. Basically, like, when she wasn't up dancing, she was sitting in the dressing room reading. Like, she was just constantly had a new book, was constantly trying to learn more, and that's something that remains true for her entire life.
Huh, good for her.
Her friends were very suspicious about her husband. There was a big age difference between the two, and Clarence was very critical and mean to her, even in front of her friends and coworkers.
I just hate that.
In the documentary, The Girl in the Picture, which is the one that I watched before we recorded this today, it's on Netflix. It's so good. Karen remembered seeing Tanya in the dressing room of the club, and she was covered in terrible bruises. She also came in one day and confessed to Karen that Clarence, her husband, had taken out a life insurance policy on her, and she was terrified that he was going to hurt her or Mike.
This is a theme into my episode.
It was clear that the two were not a happily married couple, which is probably what led Tanya into the arms of one of her clients. Kevin Brown was in love with Tanya Hughes and was planning, and they were together, they were planning their escape from Oklahoma and her escape from Clarence.
Whatever he decides his name is.
Yeah. They were going to go to Arizona and had plans for her to go to college, which was something she always had desperately wanted to do.
I wish that you could have had that.
Yeah. However, this would never come to pass as she was hit by a car as she walked home at night from getting groceries.
Hmm.
She was found by three men, and she was still alive, but died 5 days later in the hospital.
Wonder who might have done that.
They still technically don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think we all know. I think we all know.
Karen, her friend from the strip club, visited her and was talking to the nurses who were working on Tanya, and they all suspected foul play, saying that Tanya had had scratch marks on her chest that didn't really fall in line with a car accident or even getting hit and, like, thrown by a car, saying that they looked more like scratch marks, like she had been fighting with somebody.
So, like, not asphalt scratching you as you run across the road.
Yeah.
Like,
her skin wasn't torn up. Yeah.
It was just scratched.
Like someone had grabbed her and ran their nails across her. Her coworkers actually paid for her burial and headstone as well. So torn up by her sudden loss. Clarence pretty much wasn't found anywhere after her death.
Sus.
He was there for the hospital and everything like that, but after she died, he pretty much just disappeared. So her friends, Karen and Livonia, looked into her maiden name to try to find the next of kin to notify them of her passing. Her name was Tanya Tadlock. They found a number listed for her mother and called, speaking to a woman who confirmed that she was Tanya Dawn Tadlock's mother, and they broke the news to her about, you know, the worst call that a mother could ever expect to hear.
Right.
Except Tanya Dawn Tadlock had been dead for 20 years.
What? Okay. What? How? Because she was like a really sexy corpse. Yeah?
Yeah. Tanya was 20 when she died.
Nah, dog.
And Tanya Dawn Tadlock died at 18 months in infancy.
What?
So without knowing who Tanya actually was, her tombstone just read Tanya.
Oh, like Cher.
Karen was actually the person who called DHS on Clarence to check on the well-being of Michael and got Michael removed from his father's care.
Oh, good.
Because no one in Tanya's life ever trusts Clarence, Franklin, Warren, Brandon.
Oh, okay.
Nobody. Everybody is just like, this guy is a fucking skeez. Yep. He is bad news. He is dangerous. Every single person.
I'm just like, imagine having to exist a life in which everybody fucking knows that you're the worst.
Yeah, I don't think he cares.
Like, no, I'm saying, like, how do you get away with that for so long when everybody suspects you of being the dickweed that you are?
Yeah.
Like, because in my story, people were like, oh, but she was so great. And it's like, no, you didn't see it. Like, no, we know this guy hit that lady with his car.
Yeah.
We know. We fucking know Franklin, Warren, Brandon, whatever your name is.
Clarence.
Fucking Clarence.
So at this point, back up into the current investigation, Michael has been missing for 7 days when another investigator found an old friend of Franklin Floyd's who had been laying low after jumping bail. This guy basically had just been ready to talk for a long time about some things that he felt were bad.
Pertinent. Yeah.
That had happened. Mm. And the investigator handed over an old photo to a photo that the old friend had given him to Fitzpatrick, the FBI agent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This was a photo of Franklin Floyd posing with a little girl he claimed was his daughter.
Ew.
However, this photo was from 1975, and it was impossible for Floyd to have a daughter the age that the girl was in the photo because he had been in prison for 10 years prior to that. And the little girl in the photo is probably like 7 or 8.
I don't like where this is going.
Fitzpatrick guessed that the little girl in the photo had been kidnapped by Franklin as well, and the longer he looked at the picture, he was confident that the girl in the picture was Tanya Hughes.
Who was
the girl, the woman who got hit by the car.
Not Tadlock. Allegedly.
For sure.
Okay.
For sure, yeah, not Tanya Tadlock.
I'm like trying to anticipate what's coming. He stole the baby. I don't know.
When a behavioral scientist looked at the photo, they were confident that the child in the photo was definitely abused based on her mannerism and facial expression. Basically, the photo is just kind of heartbreaking knowing the situation that happened. And while you're listening to the episode, I would definitely recommend that you look up the photo just to get an idea, because it's pretty harrowing knowing, especially where this goes.
What do I look for?
Just search for, like, the girl in the photo or Tanya Hughes. It's like the cover of the documentary is the photo.
Oh god.
And it's just like a cute little girl with like really high bangs.
And she's just like,
she looks so sad.
Forward, like, yeah. Please god.
Yeah, please anybody notice that I need help because I'm 7 and don't know how to ask for help.
Oh wow.
So now the police had a series of questions. Who was Tanya really? Where did she come from? And how did Floyd get her? After the picture was given to the police and taken back in 1975, the two went through multiple states trying to evade his warrant, basically. So he left and was just going from state to state trying to find somewhere to lay low with this little girl that he had stolen. So they finally settle in Georgia 10 years later in 1984 with new identities, and she began attending high school, still under the guise of being Floyd's daughter. They were at this time going by Sharon Marshall and Warren Marshall. One of the mothers of a friend from school recognized Tanya in the reports of the kidnapping of Michael and called her daughter, Jenny, who had been best friends with Sharon in high school. Jenny reached out to the authorities to explain what she knew about Tanya when she was Sharon Marshall, and wanted to help out however she could. She was heartbroken to find out that the friend who had just kind of disappeared out of her life was dead. Aww. And then this just continued traumatic life for this poor young woman. When she spoke to the investigators, when she and her friend, the other primary in the two documentaries I watched is a gentleman named Ray, who was another good friend of theirs. When they spoke to the investigators, they had nothing but positive and nice things to say about her. She was ambitious and intelligent. She wanted to go to Georgia Tech and become an aerospace engineer and work for NASA. She wanted to serve in the Air Force. She wanted to do all of these things. However, when the conversation would come up about her father and how happy he must be, it was clear that she was not living in a happy home. Jenny would describe that she would, anytime her father would be brought up in conversation, she would look down and away and she would rub her hands together like she had a nervous tic. Her dad wasn't supportive of her and she clearly was uncomfortable talking about him. And when her mom was brought up, she would say that her mother had passed away when she was a child. She was hit on a car on a bridge and killed.
Wow.
Her friend discovered that her relationship with her dad was more than just a little awkward and uncomfortable when she was invited over to spend the night. And Jenny, her parents did not like Warren Marshall at all. They did not trust him. Her dad immediately forbid her from being anywhere in his proximity. He knew he was a bad news. Some people you just fucking know.
Yep.
And so her father was away, I think like on a business, Jenny's father was away on a business trip or something, and her mother decided, because they hadn't had any issues with them, and Sharon was a really nice girl, to go ahead and let Jenny go over and spend the night.
Oh, this sounds like a big mistake.
So the first red flag, there weren't any doors in the house. They just had curtains.
Oh, no.
And when she got there, everything was normal. Like, yeah, you know, Sharon's dad is fucking weird and gross, but like they ordered pizza, they had some soda, they're just hanging out. Nothing seems weird.
I don't like this.
And then while they were having a fun time, like typical sleepover stuff, they started laughing and giggling and getting a little loud as they were changing into their pajamas to watch a movie and hang out. And when they were basically in their underwear, Warren stormed into the room brandishing a pistol and screaming at them about being too loud.
What?
Yeah. He eventually left and said he'd be back. And when he did come back, he still had the pistol and instructed Sharon's friend Jenny to lay down on the bed and put a pillow over her head. She did as she was told, and then Warren raped Sharon at gunpoint with her friend in the room.
Oh my fucking god.
And the first episode that I watched of this, covering this case, is actually where, like, this case inspired this episode for me, because it was such a weird unraveling case. The series is actually called Pandora's Box.
Oh, okay, well.
And this is, like, episode 2 of season 1. And Jenny is unable to talk about it. at the time. She's just like, and then terrible things happen and I don't want to get into it here, and starts crying. So you know it was something bad.
Yeah.
But it's kind of left to the imagination how bad, what it was, and so on. But in the documentary, the girl in the picture, she actually does break down what actually happened. And she talks about how it just changed her. It changed her life forever. It changed how she viewed the world, how she viewed people, how she could trust, how, like, everything. She said her her entire life changed in that moment. And Jenny never told anyone what happened because she was scared of what would happen to her and to Sharon if she did say anything.
I mean, she's just a kid, like,
and in the documentary she laments it's one of her biggest regrets in life was not telling anyone when she could have maybe gotten Sharon out of the situation.
That's like, I can see how you would have that regret as an adult, but you're a kid and you're scared. It's like, you can't, Jenny, you can't put that on yourself, okay? I'm telling you, I know you're not listening, but I want you to know.
She kind of comes back in a big redemption at the end.
Oh good, I love this. I'm so ready.
I think that she got, like, while that, I'm sure that regret will be with her for the rest of her life, she got some closure for herself at the end.
That's good.
In 1986, Sharon graduated with top marks and got accepted into Georgia Tech, her dream school, with a full scholarship.
Wow.
Warren told her that she couldn't go because someone had to take care of him, and that they were going to move. And at this time, Sharon also confessed to Jenny that she was pregnant. But there's a bit of an air of mystery because we don't know for sure that she was, or if this was part of how she was, like, covering for why they had to move and why she couldn't go to school. Because she started the whole, like, I'll go to school after, you know, I have the kid and everything. And her friend Ray was just like, you won't, though. Like, if you do that, you're not going to go. You're going to lose the scholarship. You're not going to have the opportunity. But they didn't all realize that there was literally nothing she could do. In 1989, the pair showed back up in Tampa, Florida, still using the names Sharon and Warren Marshall, and Sharon began working at a strip club. The other... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, oh, but now he's her husband instead of her dad?
No, still her dad.
Okay, good. Okay, good. I mean, not good.
Not good. Still not good. The other dancers at the club did not like or trust Warren, thinking that it was exceedingly strange that a father would come to a strip club to watch his daughter work. Which,
That's weird.
Super ew. Super fucking weird. There was also a story covered, or one of the coworkers named Heather, who worked at the same club, she really, really liked Sharon and decided, like, okay, Sharon, I've got this really good in to these things that we do. They're called, like, millionaires parties. Because this was, like, a higher-end strip club. This wasn't, like, a, you know, super out in the boonies, like, gross weird strip club. Like, this is where, like, athletes and politicians and, like, those, like, the elite were kind of going here.
For the rich people.
Yeah, and so they would do these millionaires' nights, which was that each woman would go out and she was, like, required to do three dances on the stage, like, three songs, but, like, no lap dances, no touching, no stuff like that. So it was a really easy way to make a ton of money. She was like, you would leave, you know, keeping in mind this is 1989, she's like, you would leave one of these nights with $500 to $1,000 just for, you know, like, 10 minutes of work, basically, between the three songs. Not at all saying that working and dancing and doing that, all that, is easy, but for amount of money you're getting, for amount of time spent working, that's a pretty good turnaround.
Good ratio.
Yeah.
$1,000 for 10 minutes.
And then her friend Heather, who got her into this party to do this, gets pulled aside by, like, the host or the owner or whatever, and tells her, like, hey, you gotta go get Sharon and get her out. She's not, she's gotta go. And she goes over to find Sharon, and it turns out that Sharon was at the women's bathroom doing like sexual favors for $50, which she's not supposed to be doing because this is like a no touching situation and prostitution sex work is still illegal.
Yeah.
And when Heather gets upset with her because she's putting not just herself at risk doing this, but her at risk for having brought her to this party, and she asks her why, and she said, "My dad made me do it. He even bought me the condoms."
Okay.
Yeah. He's a real peach. He's a real Georgia peach.
So how did he make her do it? I want to know.
Fear, I would imagine.
Yeah.
She was, if she didn't bring home the amount of money that he expected her to, he got very upset.
Get fucked, Warren Clarence Franklin butthole face.
Yeah. He also caught another young woman in his web, 19-year-old Cheryl. So he tells Cheryl, who wants to go out to Hollywood and become a star and pose her Playboy and all these, you know, cool things she wants to do, that he's got friends and connections in California and he can get her in touch with some people. He just needs to, you know, take some headshots and get him over to who he knows, yada yada yada.
Run, Cheryl. Run as fast as you can.
And when she shows the coworker at the club the photos boasting about what Sharon's father is going to help her do, her friend brings her back down to earth. Warren Marshall is just a creepy guy who took naked photos of her, and if he had these connections with all these big time friends in California, why would he be hanging out in a strip club in Tampa, Florida?
Yep.
Heather, like I mentioned earlier, was one of the women who worked at the Tampa club with Sharon and Cheryl, and found out that there had been a video that had also been taken by Warren of the two girls dancing topless on a beach. This was also corroborated by the babysitter that they had at the time for Michael, that she would get for Michael when he was born, because when she started working here she was pregnant but she wasn't showing yet. And the babysitter would also confirm that she had seen the video on accident. Heather also recounted a story that Cheryl told her, that Warren had tried to have sex with her, and when she refused he became violent, and to retaliate against Warren, Cheryl called in a tip that Sharon had been receiving welfare checks while also working at the club, which caused the welfare checks to stop. He confronted Cheryl at the club.
Why would she do that to Sharon?
Yeah, because she was just mad.
Get fucked, Cheryl.
When he confronted Cheryl at the club, Warren was thrown out, was told never to come back, and he took Sharon and Michael with him and they left Tampa. I also think that part of it is that Sharon had probably told them that, like, the welfare checks, she wasn't getting them anyway because they were just going to him and, like, weren't actually helping her or Michael out.
Still, I feel like that tip could have been better placed, like, my friend is in danger.
Yeah.
That could have been your tip.
Yeah.
Cheryl. Cheryl, no last name.
All of the women in Sharon / Tanya's life who she worked with reported that Michael was never allowed to be out of Warren / Clarence's sight. He always had to know where she was, where he was specifically. Like, Sharon and her friend Karen in Oklahoma City Karen suggested taking him to the zoo, Michael to the zoo, and she was like, "No, we can't do that because you know, Clarence can't get off work or whatever." So they moved to New Orleans, where they changed their name again to Clarence Hughes and Tanya Tadlock. They like just picked names off of gravestones at the cemetery. Then, to make things more weird and gross, Clarence married Tanya in 1989.
No.
They would move from New Orleans to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and 9 months later, she was hit by the car and killed. The investigators decided to look into the aliases that Franklin had used in his past in order to keep an eye out for any new paperwork that was filed under those names. 2 weeks later, Agent Fitzpatrick was awoken by an urgent telephone call about a new lead.
Ooh.
The call was from Tallahassee, Florida, to apply for a license to be sent to an address in Louisville, Kentucky. At this point, it had been 2 months since Michael had been abducted.
Wow.
Finally, they had a location to expect Franklin to be at, and they quickly mobilized the SWAT team to go and take him down. An agent dressed as a FedEx man, delivery man, came to Warren Marshall's job to deliver the driver's license to him.
What a solid plan.
Yeah, it's very Silence of the Lambs with the flower delivery guy.
Yep, love that, except for, you know, spoiler alert, that didn't work.
Immediately, they asked Franklin Floyd where Michael was, and he said that the child was not with him, but that he was fine.
Uh-huh. We don't believe you, Franklin.
They searched the area and contacts for the young boy, but did not find him. None of Franklin's neighbors had seen a child, and none of his employers reported knowing about him having a child.
I don't like it.
When Franklin went from Atlanta to Louisville, his bus ticket was for one adult, and that was it. In the interrogation room, Franklin Floyd accused the foster family of abusing Michael Hughes sexually and that he had rescued him.
No.
He said that he left Michael with friends that he had made when he was on the run from the law in the 70s. And when they confronted him about Tanya, he similarly said that he had rescued her from her mother, whom he had been dating. He asserted that her mother was a sex worker and was addicted to drugs.
I hate this man. I hope he's dead.
He just keeps getting worse. We're not done.
I don't like that.
They checked out the name and location he gave to investigators about Tanya and her mother, but none of it checked out.
Of course.
And additionally, they couldn't find any evidence that he left Michael Hughes with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
While the investigators were confident that Michael had been killed by Franklin, they had no evidence to prove that was the case. And in 1995, Franklin Floyd was brought up on kidnapping charges. Two charges of kidnapping, the auto theft but with a weapon, Grand Theft Auto, brandishing, you know, like all the sorts of different things that he has done. So he kidnapped Michael, kidnapped James, held James at gunpoint, stole James's truck, you know, like went on several, you know, across state lines with a kidnapped child, theoretically. Yep. So he was found guilty on all counts levied against him for the kidnapping of Michael Hughes and was sentenced to 52 years in prison. Shortly after the trial, an agent came up to Fitzpatrick with even more news. So the truck that belonged to Principal James Davis,
yeah,
that was stolen by Warren Clarence Franklin.
Brandon.
Had been discovered. Yeah, we're not even to Brandon yet. I think it's Brandon.
I had really hoped that we were at the end of this guy's line.
So the truck is discovered. And so it searched for any evidence about Michael, anything that they can find. And then it sold in a police auction because James Davis has already replaced the car and kind of doesn't want the car of one of the worst days of his life back in his custody.
Yeah.
And so the truck was sold at auction. I think it was found in like Kansas or something, or sold to a guy in Kansas. And the new owner was doing some maintenance on it, and he had it up on lifts, like to get under the truck. And he found a manila envelope taped to the undercarriage of the truck. I know you're all dying to know.
I want to know. What is in the envelope?
There were photos of four different girls being sexually abused.
Ew, no, stop.
The majority
of I don't want to know what's in the envelope.
The majority of pictures were centered around one specific girl, and specifically as she aged. Tanya Hughes, aka Sharon Marshall. But there was another woman who appeared to have been tied up and severely beat. When Fitzpatrick noticed the tan lines on her photo, he decided to just roll the dice and reach out to the Florida police, knowing that they had lived for a number of years in Florida, to see if there had been any reports of missing young women who fit the description, since Franklin had also just come from there too.
Right.
He sent the pictures down to Tampa and received a call back almost as soon as it arrived. 2 days later, 2 days after the photos were discovered, skeletal remains were discovered off of a Tampa interstate. They found long pink acrylic nails and a bikini with the body. The clothing and the nails were exactly what the victim in the pictures was wearing.
Yikes.
However, she was still a Jane Doe. While they knew who may have killed her, they didn't know who she actually was. So they went back to the time frame that Franklin Floyd had been in the Tampa area and began looking through reports of missing women who fit the description when they found one. Cheryl Ann Camesso, the woman who Franklin had told he had connections in Hollywood to.
Nope.
Franklin Floyd was convicted of the murder of Cheryl Ann Camesso and sentenced to death in 2002. In 2002, investigative journalist Mike Birkbeck received the photo of Sharon Marshall as a child, and he knew that he had to dig into this and try to figure out who she really was. He began reaching out to people who had been involved with the case, trying to get any and all of the information he could to begin writing a book about the case.
Mm-hmm.
While writing on that book, was quickly determined that the only person who knew who Sharon really was Franklin Floyd.
Yeah.
Matt arranged to meet Franklin in prison, and they began to talk. Well, according to Matt, Franklin began to talk, and Matt just listened. Mm. Franklin was determined that if he could get his truth out there, that it would somehow free him from his sentence. He claimed innocence, and he never accepted guilt for any of the crimes that he committed. It was always not his fault, or it was someone else, or he wasn't fairly represented, or blah, 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 blah.
Get absolutely fucked.
Oh, I also, this is a tiny bit of a brief segue, back up a little bit, but at the trial, the kidnapping trial, Jenny, her friend, Sharon's friend from high school, was brought in to report, like, and to stand on the witness stand against Franklin's character.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of like representing himself to a certain extent because he thought he was super smart. He was not, spoiler alert. And he came up to her and he was just really confident, and he said, the FBI has colored your opinion of me, haven't they? And she said, no, you colored my opinion of you when I saw the kind of lingerie and underwear that you were buying for your daughter.
Wow.
And then according to her, his lawyer just took all of his paperwork and just threw it in the air and just like just fucking had it. Like, I don't want to be here.
Sorry, I don't know if you heard Jackson's commentary just now, but I booped him, so he should shut up.
But I was just like, and she, you know, what an empowering moment for her.
Yeah, for real.
To be able to stand up to this guy who, like,
who
changed her life in the worst fucking way possible.
Yeah.
But Franklin, like I said, Franklin thought if he could get his truth out there, he would somehow, people would see the light that he wasn't a bad guy and let him go. So he kept talking.
Mm.
He told Matt about an abusive upbringing after being abandoned by his mother. And Matt could understand how Franklin was made. Not that it was an excuse for what Franklin did, but he could see how the life he lived had created such a monster.
Well, and that's presuming that Franklin was telling the truth.
Yeah. Franklin said that he had his hands scalded by his teachers as punishment, and that boys in the school would regularly bully and rape him. Unfortunately, throughout writing the book, it was still undetermined what happened to Michael Hughes and who Sharon Marshall really was.
Mm-hmm.
The story began to pick up speed online, though, especially the Doe Network and Web Sleuths. So the Doe Network is a missing persons network online where people work together to try to collective consciousness who missing people are. And Web Sleuths is a website for amateur detectives that have actually helped in a number of high-profile cases.
Yeah, I know about Web Sleuths.
Web Sleuths is what helped with Golden State, too.
Yeah.
So Matt Birkbeck continued to get emails about leads and who she might be. And they got a couple of promising leads, but they had no way to test that these were family members or anything like that. They didn't have DNA from Sharon or from Michael.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2005, a bombshell of an anonymous email came through that read, quote, "Would the DNA of Sharon's daughter help you?" End quote.
What?
Megan DeFrense is Sharon's birth daughter. She learned about the case from Matt's book. Well, like, her aunt heard about the book, showed it to her mom, and then they decided together to let Megan know what was going on. And then Megan read the book. And she... So Sharon had gotten pregnant after Mike and had given the baby up for adoption in New Orleans. Megan had not been kept in the dark about her being adopted, and she had been told that Sharon had been killed in a car accident, which she had been.
Wow.
That,
whoa, what a twist.
Yeah. Megan's adoptive mother could tell things were really wrong with Franklin, with Warren and Sharon, at the adoption meeting. And so, like most of the women that he met in his life, she was incredibly uncomfortable with him. She said that he, like, completely took over the conversation about, like, who his daughter, wife at the time. So this would have been Tanya and Clarence. And so, like, who his wife would be allowed to adopt the baby to, and he wanted money for the baby, and this, that, and the other thing. And she could just tell that Tanya was not in a good situation, but she obviously didn't know the severity of the bad situation she was in. Her Megan's mother, adoptive mother, also kind of laments not having done more, because I guess there was a moment after Megan had been born that her adoptive mother came in to check on Tanya and was talking to her and was asking her, like, do you want to see the baby? Like, do you want to hold her? Like, I just want to make sure that you're okay. And she told her that no, she couldn't hold the baby specifically. That was the phrasing. Aww. And it's like, basically to this day, Megan's adoptive mother, whose name I did not write down, and I regret that now, but she just is, like, you know, trying to figure out, like, why it was just the two of us in the room. Why couldn't she have just said, like, I need help, please help me. This is, you know, he's dangerous, I'm scared. Anything that could have taken a second to just clue her in to the severity of how bad it was, because she knew something was wrong. So in 2010 or so, Megan decided to do a DNA test to see if she could find any other biological family. Having confirmed that Megan was Sharon's only known living child, in 2011, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children got involved in the case as well. So Ashley Rodriguez got the case file on Sharon Marshall and began to reach out to Joe Fitzpatrick for any information that he could help her with. And remember, Joe Fitzpatrick is the original FBI agent from the Michael Hughes case. And Joe leaps at the opportunity to get involved with this case, as the identity of Sharon and what happened to Michael were the only two cases that he had not been able to resolve before retiring. And it fucking bothered him.
Yeah.
They decided that the only way they would get answers was to go back to the source, Franklin Floyd.
Stop talking to this dude.
Scott Laub and Nate Furr were the two FBI agents who were sent out to interview Franklin Floyd. When they came in, he started to rant at them for like 45 minutes before they were finally able to explain who they were and why they were there. Again, he was silent about her identity until Agent Furr targeted something specific. He just rolled the dice and took a guess and said, Michael was going to be your next Sharon, wasn't he?
Damn.
Franklin began to cry, and that was when Agent Laub saw an opportunity to grab. He hit his hand on the table to get Franklin to focus back on him and said, how did you kill him, Floyd? He continued to cry. Laub hit his hand on the table again and asked him, how did you kill him, Floyd? And he just kept crying. And then finally, Laub slammed his fist on the table and asked him again how he killed Michael. And in an instant, he stopped crying and said, I shot him twice in the back of the head to make it real quick.
Wow.
So Franklin's a sociopath, so that's fun. Mm-hmm. Fun times. Franklin said that he buried Michael at the Oklahoma-Texas border, but after an extensive search, his remains were not recovered and still to this day have not been recovered.
Ugh, gosh.
As the interview continued, though, Franklin began to talk about a woman that he met named Sandy, who had lost her three children to the state. And Agent Furr asked him a very specific question. What was your name at the time? And he responded, Brandon Cleo Williams, a name that no one had heard him use yet. He explained that he was working as a bus driver, and he met a woman at a truck stop who had three children, and the two of them basically got married, just period.
Gross.
When
didn't she have the same, like, spidey tingle that everybody else had? The tingle thing?
Her story is very complicated, and we'll get into it in a little bit.
Okay.
And I don't know how to feel about her.
Okay.
So she got arrested and sentenced to 30 days in jail. And Franklin basically decided, fuck them kids, and dumped two of them at a local church and kept the eldest daughter. Her real name was Suzanne Servakis. Both of her parents were still alive. Sandra Servakis was interviewed in the documentary as well, and she said that she was able to immediately identify Susie as her daughter in the pictures that they had. And her first question to the agents was, do you know where she is?
Yeah, we do. She is in a grave named Tanya.
Sandra and Clifford got married right out of high school, and she got pregnant with Suzanne almost immediately after. Two were dating, seemed to be having a great future ahead of them. However, Cliff had to serve in Vietnam. And when Suzanne was born, so he was serving when she was born, and he was able to come home for a week and meet her when she was about 6 months old.
Hmm.
When he returned home from war, he was not the same man as he was when he left, because he served in a war. And Vietnam was a bad war. No war is good, but Vietnam was especially a bad war. And Sandra had started seeing another man.
Ugh, Sandra.
The two filed for divorce, and Sandra would have two other daughters, Allison and Amy. She and her three girls moved to a trailer, and then the trailer got hit by a tornado and flipped onto its side.
Oh.
Suffering from PTSD from the situation, Sandra recognized that she needed help and did what she thought she was supposed to do. She went to social services for help, but instead of helping her, they just took her children.
What the fuck, social services?
Yeah, social services can really get fucked in the story too.
Yeah.
So social services called Cliff, the dad of Susie, and said that they wanted to adopt all three of the girls out to a family together because they were so close. They were very close in age. They were like a year apart or something. And they were, you know, they didn't want to break them up. So he was basically given a choice. He could either take all three children, two of which were not biologically his, or he could let all three of them go. And those were his choices.
And he chose to let them go, I presume.
Well, he was living with his parents at the time. He was recovering from being in the war. He had,
it's the choice I would have made in his position.
He had a bit of a drinking problem. He was unemployed, and he admits in the documentary, they interview him too, and you know, you can tell that he's obviously broken up about the decision that he made.
Yeah.
But he was just like, at the time, I didn't see how I possibly could have been a good father.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, of course, had he known what kind of father she would eventually have, I'm sure he would have made a different choice.
Right. It wasn't you don't expect that that's going to be the life that any child is going to have.
Mm-hmm. So at the time that Sandra went to social services, they suggested that she go to church to get right with God about losing her kids.
What state is this? I'm sorry, I forget.
This one, I think she was, Suzanne was born in Michigan, but I'm not sure where this is actually happening. I think it must have been Michigan or somewhere near that.
Well, you said a tornado, so I kind of more assumed more south than that.
Yeah. Let's see, where did it go?
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I just scrolled up a little bit on accident. So Sandra did go to church, and she was praying, and she was trying to figure out, like, her life is just kind of, you know, flipped, turned upside down, and how do I handle this PTSD? How do I get my kids back? Like, I need help, but I don't need them not here. I can't take care of them by myself right now. I just need help. Right. I don't need them gone. And while she was there, she started speaking to a man who seemed very nice and very gentle. And he asked her what was wrong. And he offered to help her go get her children and even get married and help her take care of the kids.
After one conversation?
Yeah.
Gross.
And his name?
Red flag.
Franklin Floyd.
Let's go, Brandon.
So once the children were back in her care, Brandon showed his true colors.
Yeah, sure.
He became increasingly violent, increasingly aggressive. She said that he carried a knife with him everywhere he went and threaten, like, oh, you think you're gonna leave me? And would, like, reach for his knife that he kept on him. And it was just obviously a bad situation to be in. She said that she had needed to buy diapers for Amy, the baby, and had to write a bad check to the 7-Eleven, and she got caught for it, and that's why she had the 30 days in jail.
Mm.
When she was released, she immediately went to the police when her kids were missing. She had no idea where they were, but because she was legally married to him, there wasn't anything that the police could do for a civil dispute involving the children. He's the dad. He can just take them somewhere. He can just go out of state with these kids. And then Amy and Allison, the two younger daughters, were dropped off at an orphanage, and she was able to get them back. But she never knew what happened to Suzanne.
That is horribly awful.
Yeah. So Heather, going way back to one of her coworkers in Tampa, Heather 100% blames Sandra for everything that happened.
Okay.
Because Heather also got kidnapped in the 1970s for several years.
What?
And her mother did everything that she could to find her.
Wow.
She spent all the money she could. She reached out to news stations. She wrote letters. She reached out to senators. Anyone that could help. And so she does not at all understand why Sandra didn't. And had she done that, she might have been able to find her daughter and get her back. But she didn't.
That, you know, that's a super fair assessment. I mean, I don't know how I would react in a situation where my kid went missing, but I don't think it would be to go, oh, well,
yeah,
they're gone.
Oh, I got 2 out of 3. Ain't bad.
Then, you know, then again, with her lived experience of going to the authorities and then having your kids taken away, or having your fucking, you know, story go, oh, well, that's her dad.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that was why she didn't. She was like, well, they're not going to do shit for me anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
They might just take my other two kids. Like, I don't know. I don't know about you, Sandra. Seems pretty sus.
So Megan's adoptive mother has also reached out to Sandra and was surprised to find that Sandra didn't seem to care too much about knowing her granddaughter or anything.
Okay, no, fuck you, Sandra.
So now that they knew the identity of Suzanne, Matt Burbeck reached out to Megan to get a new headstone commissioned for her grave. She actually had like a full memorial. Joe Fitzpatrick was there, all the people who were still alive who worked on her case, her dad, Megan, Megan's mother, her friends from Georgia, like everybody that could be there that was involved in her life was there for her memorial. Her gravestone now reads, Suzanne Marie Savakis, devoted mother and friend. Cliff and Megan have remained in contact.
Oh, Cliff.
And Megan named her first son Michael after her brother.
That's what it was like. I'm crying.
I know.
Cliff coming in clutch with Grandpa.
Yeah, and he says in the documentary too, he's like, I can't talk to Suzanne, but I can talk to Megan, and that'll do.
Dang, what a wild ride.
Right? Yeah, the documentary is fantastic. It is...
I'm gonna watch it.
I wouldn't say it's the hardest documentary to watch. I think the hardest documentary I've watched was where they actually interviewed one of the surviving members of Jonestown. And we had to pause and ugly cry for a minute.
Oh yeah.
But this one is it's pretty visceral because they're in like this is a crime that happened in the last, you know, 20, 30 years. Like this isn't that old in the grand scheme of things. Like these people right. who were 16, 20 or 16, 18 in the 80s are now in their 40s and 50s,
mm-hmm.
like 60s. So they're still very aware. They're still very connected to the case. They still remember everything. And like Sandra still, she's very, Sandra and Cliff, they were really young parents. And so, you know, they both remember everything. And like, it's not like you're talking to like a, you know, doddering sweet old grandpa. You know, he is right there with it. He's aware of everything, the whole conversation and everything like that. So it kind of brings into reality like this was happening like in some of our listeners' lifetimes.
Yeah.
Like that she was alive and she was in Georgia and she was in Florida and she was in Oklahoma. And I really want to figure out what cemetery she's at and go give her some flowers. Like she's in Tulsa. Yeah. She's buried in Tulsa. Yeah. And I just I don't know, I feel like I should. You do have to find a grave.
Yeah. Is it Suzanne with a Z?
Yeah.
Okay. Savakis.
Servakis.
1969 to 1990.
Yep.
She is in Park Grove Cemetery, Broken Arrow, Tulsa.
Okay, so she's in Broken Arrow.
God, she was gorgeous.
Yeah, she was so fucking pretty. And like, and so smart. Like getting into Georgia Tech with a full ride.
With a full ride? What the
wanting fuck, she wanted to work for NASA. Like, she was that smart. She was that
she's beautiful, fucking brilliant, and Franklin, but fuck, Brandon Floyd, whatever, ruined it, and we hate him.
He ruined a lot of things.
And I hope he's dead.
I didn't see if he's dead or not. He was alive at least in 2014.
I don't even care. I'm just gonna assume he's dead because he's dead to me. That's what I'm gonna say.
He is, as of July 13th, 2022, he is alive and awaiting execution in Rayford, Florida. 79 years old. Franklin Delano Floyd.
Delano? Like,
They all said Delano. Like Roosevelt? Yeah, but I've always, I don't know. I've heard it pronounced both ways, because Adore Delano does Delano, that's spelled like Delano.
Oh, all right, well.
Thanks for joining us today as we unravel this spiderweb of a case. We hope you'll reach out to us with your own experiences, maybe not experiences directly related into a case like this, but we want your stories, your questions, and your feedback. Send us an email at strangeunusualpodcast@gmail.com. If you're sending a story, we just ask that you put listener story in the subject line so we can sort through those a little more easily. I mean, not that our listenership of like 10 people aren't gonna probably have this, but like if anybody did know, you know, Sharon or parents knew, you know, Sharon or Tanya or Suzanne, that would be incredible. But it's just, man. And then like all of the stuff about like her having another child and all that, like I got all those twists were new to me as of today. Yeah. Because I was just sort of like watching the end of the documentary and I was like, oh yeah. And then the documentary starts wrapping up and then I paused it to mess with Mothra. And I looked and I was like, why are there 45 minutes of this documentary left? I was like, oh, some shit has gone down. Okay, let's rewind a little bit and get back into note-taking time.
Yep. Well, with that said, you can also find us on Instagram at strange_unusual_podcast or on our personal accounts, Roy Rampage and Calamity Casey. You can find us on Twitter at _strangeunusual, at Calamity Casey, and at Roy Rampage. We are on Facebook, just search for the Strange Unusual Podcast. And if you like, you can join us over on patreon.com/strangeunusual. But with the world being what it is, you don't have to support us financially. I would much rather you at this point donate to your local abortion fund, to be quite honest. But that said, if you could help us out by giving us a share, review, like, subscribe, all those wonderful things that you can do on the internet with these various podcast venues, we would really appreciate your love and support. And shout out to us on social media. And that's that.
I'm looking to see if we've got any new reviews.
We got a very nice comment on Instagram.
Oh, we got a new review.
Oh, okay. Is it a nice one? Or is it a mean one?
No, it's a nice one. It's 5 stars.
Ooh.
It says, this is the only show I can actually listen to. Such a great connection, but the hosts don't spend too much time chatting. Wow. Thank you, Lauren. That's the opposite of what we heard.
Lauren, I think, is the one who sent us a nice thing on Instagram as well.
And it's a perfect mix of fun and sticking to the topics. Cannot recommend enough. Thank you so much, Lauren. We really appreciate it.
Yes, Lauren commented on our vampire post for Instagram as well. Thanks, Lauren.
Kisses. I'm gonna look that up. I think you saw it before I did, so I didn't get alerted to it.
All right. Well, with that said, peace out, y'all.
Bye.